Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 130 of the Bugle audio newspaper for a visual world for the week beginning Monday, the 11th of October, 2010, with me, Andy Zaltzman, the man that blues legend Muddy Waters could have been if he'd been born in mid-1970s England and been privately educated. And joining me live from the city of a thousand sandwiches and plenty more besides, New York, it's the Emeritus Professor of Funk from Funkston College, University of Funktown, Funksylvania. It's John, thank you very much, Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. I owe all my teaching in Funk, Andy, to my mentor, Bootsy Collins.
Of course you do, mate.
I did a big benefit for autism on Saturday, which incidentally raised $3 million so far. Pretty good. But part of that was through auctions on the night. And there were two incredible items which raised a combined $40,000. First, you could bid for Chris Rock to come on stage and call your ex-boyfriend to swear at him. And that proved extremely popular, and to be fair to him, when the time came, he left it all on the field. You couldn't hear much of the guy's reaction on the other end, but it is one phone call I don't think he'll be forgetting for a long time. And the other phenomenal item was a trilobite fossil, an amazing artifact, you know, millions and millions of years old.
Well, that's got a lot of storage on, hasn't it?
Well,
trilobite, what's that?
Yeah, The thing that made this extra special was it was signed by George Clooney, Andy. And part of the lot involved you also flying out to LA to meet him, where he said he would sign it again. A
wow.
Trilobite signed twice by George Clooney is significantly better than a trilobite signed no times by George Clooney. One of the building blocks of life on Earth, autographed twice by one of the finest physical examples of its residence in history.
It must have been amazing for the archaeologist who dug it up
found
a trilobite with George Clooney's signature on.
That's what makes it so valuable.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the chances?
Yeah.
I'm drinking Gorilla Coffee today,
right,
Andy. So it might be a high energy bugle, this.
All right.
It's Gorilla Coffee from Brooklyn. It is serious slap in the face coffee,
is it,
Andy?
It's a
serious bean. It has absolutely no sense of humor, this bean.
It's not like
you're growing hair on your nose.
I know. It's going hard to the hoop, this coffee.
That was the subtext of Teen Wolf, wasn't it? It was just. I thought, is this Gorilla Coffee not like that famous civet coffee, which is made from coffee beans that have been eaten and shat out by a civet monkey? Because I don't know what they do with gorilla coffee as well.
No, this isn't the kind of gorilla that, you know, it looks majestic in the jungle. This is the kind of gorilla that pounds on its chest and tries to rip your face off.
So this is Bugle 130, which means there have now been more episodes of The Bugle than there are ways to skin a cat. We're not sure how many of those there are, but anecdotal evidence suggests the number is definitely more than one. Different types of cheese in the average Venezuelan fridge, that's now one. The standardised national cheese, the Hugo Cheesevez. Also, the number of effigies of himself owned by George W. Bush. He used to pick one up as a souvenir on every overseas trip he did. Just, you know, it's good to have a hobby.
Yep.
And also swear words edited out of the first draft of the Gettysburg Address. 43 of those in total. Comics often do that when they're worried about how the crowd are going to react.
Yep.
They just up the swearing to make themselves look tougher.
But
luckily, Lincoln ended up having to do the speech before the 9 p.m. swearing watershed, so it came out clean. But we do have the original first draft I found on the internet, some of which went 47 f***ing years ago. Our fathers brought forth on this f***er of a continent a new f***ing nation, conceived in f***ing liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all f***ing men are created f***ing equal. F***. Finishing, government of the f***ing people, by the f***ing people, for the f***ing people, shall not f***ing perish from the f***ing earth. For f*** sake, I've been Abe, you've been great, see you all again.
Well, is it less poetic? Maybe. Is it more powerful? Unquestionably. He really drills that point home.
In this bugle, historic bugle, we will pass the 3.5 days of total bugle time. If you listen to them all back to back, it would now take you more than half a week.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know if that's something to be proud of or ashamed of.
I think both. Top story this week, I have only one burning desire. Let me stand next to your fire. Andy, There was an amazing incident in Tennessee last week.
That's a new one in your repertoire, that.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Introduced, first time. Well, no, to be honest, there are amazing incidents in Tennessee every week, but those amazing incidents usually involve the spectacular barbecuing of various meats, or are incidents contained in the narrative of heartbreaking country songs. Sometimes those songs are, in fact, about the spectacular barbecuing of meats. Interesting side note, Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man is actually about standing next to your man while he marinades a brisket. Anyway, here's the story. In Obion County in rural Tennessee this week, the fire department stood back and watched a family's home burn to the ground because they had forgotten to pay a $75 annual subscription fee. Now, you might well ask, why didn't the fire brigade put out the fire? And I'm sure the homeowner, Gene Cranick, asked that question both quietly to himself and loudly to the fire brigade as together they stood and watched his house burn to the floor. Well, Obion County is outside the city of South Fulton's reach, so the fire department there require homeowners to pay a voluntary fee if they want to be covered. Cranick said that he'd paid the fee in the past and that it had simply slipped his mind this year, and that even when he offered to pay whatever the cost might be to put out the fire department refused to respond during the 2 hours it took for the flames to spread from his garden to his house. Wow. Wow, Andy.
That's an impressive effort. It's basically the fire department just replicated the Bush government's attitude to Hurricane Katrina, I think.
That's basically true. South Fulton doesn't care about rural white people. Now, this is a very, very complicated situation. And, you know, there are two sides to the argument regarding the fire. On one hand, yes, he didn't pay his $75 fee. And it's very hard to motivate anyone to pay it if you keep waiving the fee every time there's a fire. Maybe he forgot. Maybe he was trying to cheat the system. Who knows? But, on the other hand, pour some fucking water on it. You're sitting in a fire truck weighed down with heavy, heavy water. He's got a house that just happens to be on fire. I've got a great idea for how to make your truck lighter and his house less hot. Pour some fucking water on it. Now, back to the first-hand argument, Andy. You could also argue that the fire department showed admirable restraint here. They risk their lives every day on these calls. Many of them are volunteer firemen, and all they're asking for is $75 a year for helmets, hoses and ping-pong balls. In many ways, the homeowner is lucky that they weren't lighting cigars off his living room couch or toasting marshmallows off his family photo album. But then again, on the other hand, Andy, although this seems complicated, at its core, it's actually quite simple. One, they had water. Two, they saw fire. So three, pour some fucking water on it!
Tennessee, incidentally, the state that sounds most like the answer to the exam question, describe Steffi Graf in one adjective. But, but it was a bit galling, you know, to be standing there watching it burn down, rather than not even, you know, if they'd just not turned up, that's a different matter. But to turn up and then watch it, that just looks vindictive. I do hope they actually had the hoses on and were just firing them in the air and catching the water in their mouths, just to show him what he could have had. Because it's very much similar to when you're having a heart attack in a hospital. The last thing you want to see is a doctor checking whether you've paid your subs or not, and waving the defibrillator in front of your face, saying, ah, who's been a naughty and tight-fisted boy? Then using that defibrillator to make a cheese and ham toasty. Bread, Brunswick, Emmental, zzz, clear, zzz, oh, yum, yum.
At least it's a nice toasty that he went with there, Andy. Now, see, that's the thing. Although this is an isolated incident, it does have wider implications, as this has illustrated a potential way forward for government funding, not just in America, but possibly all over the world. Do we collectively move towards a mix-and-match-your-own version of government services so that you can opt in and out of whatever services you want? You know, maybe you'd like to save money by not having any refuse collection every week and instead setting fire to your own rubbish in your backyard and then choose to pay for fire protection in case it gets out of hand. Now, you can design it yourself.
I think, we can apply this across the board. Teaching, for example, pay for per fact. You know, you have a teacher at the front of the kids, they're the class saying, right, kids, catapults down, bandanas off, it's lesson time. Right, last week you all paid me enough money to tell you how the Normans and the Saxons came to be squaring up at the Battle of Hastings. When you've collectively put £30 in that bucket, I will tell you who won.
Well, that's already people in America can roll the dice and not have health insurance. It may not be that way for much longer, but it still is the case now, on the understanding that if they turn up to the emergency room, they're going to get seen anyway. A hospital won't leave you bleeding on the side of the road. This man just assumed that the fire service would put it out anyway, and the fire department called his bluff, Andy. They called his bluff, and they watched that f***er burn. You do feel sorry for both sides involved in this situation, which is clearly just a demonstration of a massively flawed system breaking down. But, of course, you know, the conservative or the libertarian argument here is that this is actually a perfect example of the system working fantastically well. America is the land of the free, Andy, and this man was free to make life a bit more exciting for himself. Every time he lit a candle, he was basically stepping into a homemade casino. He was playing flame roulette every time he turned his gas hob on.
But it's basically bribery, John, this £75 subscription. And bribery, I think we talked about bribery as a form of taxation a few months ago on the Bugle. And I stand by my theory that this is the future of public funding. You fork out as and when you require a public services. And this is essentially what Gene Cranick tried to do. He basically said, I'll pay you $75 to stop my house burning down. And they said, oh no, that's more than my job's worth. I said, all right, I'll cover all your costs. And they replied, add a nought onto that and we can start talking. And that's basically how it works. The Inland Revenue in this country already uses brown envelopes, basically admitting that when you send in your tax, the subtext is basically, hey, Mr. Government, I want my kid to go to an adequate school and my granny not to freeze to death this winter. I can't do that. Sure, how about if I just slip you a nice couple of G's into this envelope here? Our little secret. I'll ask my boss. You drive a hard bargain. I'll stick a bit more in there for you. Okay, we have a deal. Little Timmy will have a new test tube in his chemistry lab and old Morag can switch a heater on for 10 minutes at bedtime. You're a gentleman.
It's true. Well, the system also runs the risk of turning essential emergency services into protection rackets. You could just have fire engines patrolling towns late at night, flicking matches out of the window, saying, oops, let's hope no one has a little accident here. The fire department, in fact, only turned up to the blaze when the flames threatened to spread to a neighbouring property who had paid the $75 fee. And it's just insane, Andy. This could obviously all be sorted out just by growing up and taxing people properly. You shouldn't be able to opt out of a fundamental emergency service. It's just not a sensible decision. Having water sprayed on your burning home is not a luxury item like a robot butler. It's a fundamental service that should be provided through your taxes.
Well, I don't know, John. I mean, is it right that I pay my taxes when my house has never caught on fire? To people who like live in ovens or something, right, whose house routinely catches on fire every meal time. I just don't see why that's fair. They made this lifestyle choice.
You know, when you
I'm
put
the
it
one
like
who
that,
has to subsidise it.
When you put it like that, Andy, it does seem completely unfair.
Well, we're having a huge argument in this country about what public money should be spent on. The government has announced plans to cap welfare payouts at a maximum of £500 per week for any one family, regardless of how big that family is. It hasn't gone down tremendously well, particularly not when the news has been broken by people for whom £500 a week just about covers their wine expenditure. And the Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, advised the poor to stop having so many children in order that this cut wouldn't affect them so badly.
Dear.
I think the key that he missed out really was to advise them to stop having so many poor children and to start trying to have richer children, which I think would help. And talking about this proposed £500 a week benefit ceiling, he said it would encourage responsibility in people, the kind of responsibility that that Jeremy Hunt himself probably finds a little easier to adapt to with his estimated $4 million personal fortune. And that £26,000 a year maximum benefit figure, in fact, just slipped under the annual fees at Jeremy Hunt's old school, Charterhouse. So you can kind of understand why his comments have wound people up a little bit.
He wants to be very careful with sentences like that, Andy, because the logical extension to that train of thought involves the next sentence featuring the word sterilisation.
I think basically the attitude is if you haven't got the money, you shouldn't have children. And I wonder if Jeremy Hunt and the Conservatives will have the balls to take this further and start kidnapping babies from scruffy-looking mothers, or even making midwives hammer babies back into their mummies' wombs until their mummy has written a suitably sized cheque to make sure they can cover the cost of their brand-new, beautiful bundle of lifestyle choice. Tell you who I blame, John. Queen Victoria. 9 children, never paid for a f***ing thing in her life. Swanned around as if she owned the place. 42 grandchildren, all of them sponging off their inherited wealth and land, pissing around Europe, starting wars and stuff. No wonder this continent's gone to shit.
World leader update now. And Andy, the man who puts the mad in Ahmadinejad has been at it again this week. Hezbollah's TV station reported that he hopes to find time during a visit to Lebanon next week to throw a rock at Israel. He'll be visiting the border and he wants to throw a rock to demonstrate how much he hates Israel. And I really don't think he needs to demonstrate that anymore, Andy. I don't think there are many people on this planet who are not fairly clear about his feelings regarding that particular country. So essentially, it's going to be like a ceremonial first pitch, but you'll have to be careful, Andy. There's a lot of pressure that's going to be on it. You don't want to throw it too short. Otherwise, you know, you've just unwittingly thrown a rock at Lebanon, your hosts, nor do you want to throw it straight up in the air and have it land on your head. I just can't wait for the video footage of it to come through, because I hope that he throws like a little girl. I think that would be appropriate, Andy, just a petulant little hand flap and it landing 4 feet in front of him. Maybe he'll go with a huge stone instead, go for size, and throw it shot put style, tucking it under his chin and launching it across the border. There are so many decisions for him to make.
Well, John, I can tell you exactly how it's going to work out now because I have inputted all the facts into my computer and it's generated some predictive commentary on the stone throwing when it takes place shortly. And here it is. And here's Mahmood now stepping up to the throwing zone, just limbering up that arm of his that we've seen wave rapidly at so many UN meetings. So it's over now to Jeff, who's right down by the border. Thanks, Nigel. And it looks like Ahmadinejad has chosen a rather nice man-made granite sandstone composite for a throw, made by Callaway, I think. That will give him good weight for a hard impact on Israeli soil with the graphite and the sandstone. Should give him a little bit of additional splatter on contact, so a bit of a right-to-left crosswind here in Lebanon this afternoon for the 53-year-old former governor of Ardabil province. So he might throw this with a little bit of draw to fade it into the breeze and hit Israel full-on.
Quiet, please!
One last look over his shoulder from the sixth president of the Islamic Republic and professional brinksmanship sailor. A couple of deep breaths, clasping the stone in that split finger grip in his right hand. The one-time mayor of Tehran looks at Israel again. Oh, he's crossed himself. Well, that is a surprise, a real surprise there. And well, back goes his arm, reminiscent of a young Roger Clemens, his throwing coach, of course. Here comes the fling, and oh, he's topped it. He hasn't even hit Israel. That's a bad miss by Mahmood. Well out of the strike zone. He'll be disappointed with that, the former civil engineering student and father of three. But not half as disappointed as the extremist clerics in his country. Not good to miss a throw at a 22,000 square kilometre target. Although, of course, Mahmood would say it's only 20,000 square kilometres when you take out the Golan Heights in East Jerusalem. And we've only got two more stones. He'll have to hit Israel with one of those, because if he doesn't, he could easily leave Iran vulnerable to a nuclear strike. Back to you in the studio.
Bolivian bollock news now. And even better than Ahmadinejad throwing a stone was this week Bolivia President Evo Morales, who took part in a charity football match against a team of political rivals and used the opportunity to knee an opponent in the balls. It really is something to behold. Definitely worth looking up on YouTube. Local media in Bolivia said that, I quote, the receiving player crumpled in agony, holding his testicular zone. Come on, Bolivia. Say balls. You mean balls. Say balls. Are you, Victorian London? Come on.
Isn't the testicular zone a new part of Disney's new medically themed theme park in Florida?
It is. It was also the name of the band you were in when you were 12.
That's right, yeah. But Morales had been fouled by opposing player Daniel Cartagena and retaliated by giving Cartagena a full kneecap slap bang into his Brian and Ethel Murgatroyds. Cartagena then Collapsed to the ground, as you say, clutching his haggis, neep and tatty. Morales was the first serving president to strike someone full in their professor's scroty in the dangle bag since Francois Mitterrand kicked Ronald Reagan in his plum crumbles during a game of canasta at the UN in 1986. Reagan, of course, retaliated by trying to punch Mitterrand in his mazel tovs, but the Frenchman was too quick for him and Reagan could only land a glancing blow on his magic French unihorn.
I hope you're proud of yourself.
I'm 36.
The charity match was to inaugurate a renovated stadium in the capital of Paz. And what better way to christen a football stadium, Andy? This is entirely appropriate. It's like breaking a champagne bottle on the side of a warship. This should be the way that it is done from now on. A ceremonial kick to the balls to open every stadium. What's great is not just that this happened, but the reaction to it. The response could have been critical of Morales for basically committing common assault. Instead, it's been overwhelmingly positive. Perhaps this will have a knock-on effect and world leaders will just go around kneeing their opponents in the balls. It's going to make debates a lot more interesting in future. You're going to want to be very careful shaking your opposition's hand in the start. Because he may try to deliver a knockout nutshot before you've even begun.
I think it's what you want to see in your president. You want a man who's confident enough to stand up for himself and powerful enough not to get hauled across the coals when he gets caught. And
yeah.
I'd like to see David Cameron start punching his weight on the sports field. I mean, we haven't had a leader prepared to do that since Clement Attlee skewered Stalin in the eye with a snooker cue whilst taking a needlessly long backswing on an ambitious three-ball plant. But interestingly, Morales was not sent off for this. He was not sent off. I mean, it's shades of the Dutch behaviour in the World Cup final. That's what set the precedent for this. I mean, I really think that Nigel de Jong and Mark van Bommel have got a lot to answer for when it comes to Bolivian presidents kneeing people in the balls. But the victim was sent off, and Morales' team, which is entirely made up of bodyguards, one of them was sent off as well. And there were four men off in total. But that's a good team, isn't it? A president and 10 bodyguards.
Yeah, very good.
He was wearing the number 10 shirt as well. That's good to see. Good to see. He sees himself as a playmaker. Your emails now, and thanks for your emails again this week. Many of them alerting our attention to the Evo Morales story. Some slagging off Chris, some in support of Chris. Unusually, they all bounce off you now, don't they? Some congratulating John on his engagement, which has hit the media this week.
It did, Andy. That was not intentional.
Have you sold the photos yet?
No.
You sold the photo, right?
No, I haven't. Yeah. That was on the way into the autism. On the way into the autism benefit. My now fiance talked to someone who she didn't realise was a journalist, and I think I also naturally assumed that it would not be newsworthy, but apparently I was incorrect in that.
Right.
Not quite
so many emails congratulating me on my birthday this week. But,
No, Andy.
What's no? No, I'm sure your one's just stuck in the system, isn't it, John? Stuck in the system. Some excellent bird flipping emails, of which the best is clearly this: Dear Andy, Chris and John, alphabetical by first name order. I don't want to show favouritism and I don't know Chris's surname in order to do alphabetical by surname. Fair enough. His surname is Aardvark. In your search for the greatest bird ever flipped, I thought that the bird flipped by Italian artist Maurizio Catalan in the Piazza d'Affari at the Italian Stock Exchange might be of interest for two reasons. A, it's flipping big, 11 metres high to put a number on it. B, it's at bankers and let's face it, they probably deserve it. And this is, for those who have not seen it, and I will attempt, after my success last week, to tweet the picture. It is an 11-metre-high bird. Very accurately done. So, I mean, it's a hugely impressive sculpture, really.
And it's pointed directly at the Milan stock market as well.
Yep.
So, really, it's sending a message that the whole world wants to send. He truly is the people's artist.
I want to see that on the plinth in Trafalgar Square.
Yeah, I'm 100% behind this. It's sculpted apparently from Carrara marble, the same material used by Michelangelo and Bernini. And, you know, this is just a natural extension of their work. You know, if he'd been around for a little bit longer, he'd have realised David didn't need his body and Wang. You just needed a solid David bird.
Michelangelo must have sculpted a bird at some point.
He must have done.
He cannot have spent so long sculpting a human form and not just thought, I wonder what it'll look like if I sculpt a bird.
It would be incredible if that's what he'd done with David. He did, at that point, the most magnificent sculpture that any human had carved from marble in its history. And if he just started to waste it at the end by flipping the bird.
Another sculptor-based alert comes from Christian Harden, who writes, Dear Andy and John, in order of virility. I'm sure I don't need to tell you guys this, but a 4-foot-high statue depicting a golden sausage has been unveiled in Novokuznetsk, Russia, in order to celebrate the town's favourite food. The story combines A, large, ludicrous, opulent structures, B, a foodstuff, C, funny foreigners, and D, gold. What more do you want? I want Andy's Russian accent. Хорошо, колбаса. Well, I mean, yes, a good sausage. Good sausage. Yeah. Right. Good sausage. I don't think sausages and salamis are sculpted enough these days. I think that's something Michelangelo must have done. He must have sculpted his favourite foods.
There's no way there isn't a marble ravioli somewhere.
He can't have always had commissions on. He must have sometimes done some stuff for himself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a little hot dog, wasn't it?
Hot dog, a little a lasagna, yeah. A full lasagna. But just with the offcuts from David, you know, that's a lot of marble. He will have done some, you know, little lamb chop.
Yeah, in fact, Dave, the way David's hand is in that sculpture, it suggests that originally it was sculpted, he was holding a packet of crisps.
Or spinning a pizza in the air. That's it. Because originally, David was going to be a sculpture for the roof of a pizza restaurant.
Bit racist, mate. So, do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Sport now, and when I say sport, I mean another email. It comes from Steve O in Zaragoza, Spain. Seriously, he says, as if we wouldn't believe such an outlandish claim.
I completely believe that people live in Zaragoza.
Yeah, but would you believe someone called Steve lived there?
No, that's true. Yeah, I doubt that.
Anyway, on the subject, Red Sox, Liverpool. Hello, John and Andy. Chris. I thought you would be interested to know that the owners of the Boston Red Sox, the greatest sports franchise in the world, have made a bid for the British football club Liverpool. Soon, John, Liverpool and the Sox could be sister teams, as it were. Mull that over, you Mets fan. By the way, ouch, Mets firing both their manager and general manager. That sucks. Really speaks to the quality of that franchise, don't it? Come over to the superior team, the Boston Red Sox. Yours and Christ stroke bugled. I'm not sure those two mixed together.
They are mutually exclusive. as is the case with your off-the-cuff Bible crossword joke, Andy. it's a disaster for Liverpool, Andy, in a series of catastrophes. Really, American influence has not been good in Liverpool the last 5 years. People are very close to burning flags in the street at the moment. It is terrible. Terrible. I find it hard to even joke about, Andy. We might be about to go into administration and lose 9 points.
God, that really puts it all in perspective.
Ugh, it's just awful.
That's like Hiroshima and Nagasaki all together in one.
Yeah, times 15.
I think we should probably all just have a little moment to think about that.
Yeah. 9 points. 9 points. I mean, they still won't go down, but 9 points.
They might get down. They're very bad. I mean, they've lost to Blackpool and Northampton. At Anfield, John. I mean,
it's terrible.
It's just terrible. Just eerily reminiscent of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire.
It's true.
Just years of gradual decay, and then all of a sudden, bang!
Gone.
Here are the Visigoths. Or Ostrogoths. I forget which franchise of the Goths it was in the end. In other sports, there's been dancing in the streets of Athens, Warsaw, Vilnius, Tirana and Belgrade this week, John, because Europe won the Ryder Cup.
Yes.
What a continent. What a continent. Take that, America. This continent Continent that produced Leonardo da Vinci beat the continent that produced Sister Sledge. I think that tells you all you need to know. Tells you all you need to know. It was a great day. I was there on the Monday.
Yeah.
And it was muddy. And
it was that's it. That was what you took away from it.
I think muddy. And we watched Tiger Woods for a bit. And I think I can confirm that Tiger Woods is still good at golf.
Okay.
Yep. He was certainly hitting a golf ball with a golf club pretty close to some golf holes.
Okay. That's what he was wanting.
That's what he wanted from the golf tournament on the golf course. And the most striking shot of the day was Hunter Mahan at the what proved to be the last hole, the 17th
hole.
Great name. And the tension was incredible. He needed to win the last two holes to win the match for America. And on the 17th green, there were about 30,000 people at a green designed for about 20 people. And it looked like Mahan was slightly overawed by the situation. He had a little chip to get onto the green after leaving his drive short. And he fluffed it, John. I don't say this lightly, but I reckon I could have played a better shot than Hunter Mahan.
Oh, steady on, Andy.
And I think he'd just seen that there were a lot of people like me who were standing precariously on a very muddy bank about to go mental when the continent that we all love so dearly won, and he thought, I cannot have 10,000 people jumping up and down on a muddy bank simultaneously on my conscience. I'm just going to fluff this shot and call the game off. So what he did was for the good of humanity, John. And I think any criticism he got from the American press is way out of line. Well, on a big, I think it is kind of bizarre, the Ryder Cup, because in this country, we are fairly sceptical about Europe as an entity, apart from when the Ryder Cup is on. And I think if the government ever wanted to get through a referendum on joining the Euro, they would have to hold it the day after a winning Ryder Cup. Otherwise, there was absolutely no chance it will get through. And it was, of course, a personal triumph for the European captain, Colin Montgomery, who generally has the look of a man who has accidentally ordered 20 tons of sardines to be dropped on his front lawn. And generally talks as if a round of golf is roughly equivalent to invading Russia in the middle of winter in terms of difficulty and emotional stress. So, well done, Monty. Now, tell your face. And in a quick Commonwealth Games update.
Oh, it's been great. It's been great, Andy. What a total farce.
No, they had uncalibrated boxing scales.
Oh.
There was a huge controversy at the women's 100 metres in which there was a false start, and it turned out that the guy who was supposed to be overseeing the false starts wasn't there. He just hadn't turned up.
It's brilliant. The 10-metre diving board is apparently 10.7 metres. Yeah. The sandpit has apparently been infested with moths. Come on! Two-thirds of the British swimming squad have come down with serious stomach upsets because apparently the water's poisoned from pigeon droppings. Come on, Andy.
That's what sport's all about.
This is phenomenal.
I love this diving board story. And so I think it's a nice old-style casual attitude towards sport. Because sport is so scientific these days and so regulated. And I think that this really says, jump off this into that. How complicated can it be? And I like that. And also, the divers have it too easy. They always know exactly where the water is. And they can prepare everything. There's no variables in diving. That's why it's not a more popular sport. And if they had to react a bit more, then I think it would be much more exciting. And I think it'd be more if it was more gladiatorial if they had two diving boards at opposite ends of the pool, and they hurled themselves off, and whilst doing pike back somersaults, had to wrestle each other for first entry into the water. I think this is just opening new avenues for diving that could make it just as popular as WWF wrestling. Is it still called that or not?
No, it's not called that at all, and it hasn't been for a long time.
Oh, well, that's a shame. That's why I don't watch it.
But that's the amazing thing. This is also great news for the London Olympics in 2012, Andy, because the Commonwealth Games has significantly lowered the bar of competence to the point that it just can't help but be a success now. The success of the Chinese Olympics is just a distant memory. We needed this.
So that's about it for this week's Bugle. Do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. A quick forecast. Well, what's going to happen in the rest of the Commonwealth Games, John? I think it might turn out that the athletics track is, in fact, on a tectonic fault line.
Could be.
And there could be, during the steeplechase, just an earthquake opening up the track. Like in that scene in Superman when she's driving the car. You know yes. that one. and gets, yeah, it'd be like that, but more so. That's it. I need to go get some sleep.
Do it. And no, yeah. Who's stopping you?
No, nothing. No, just why not? It's just I've been waiting up for your birthday card all week. That's all.
It's coming.
It's coming, is it? Right.
It's coming. Hang in there.
36. It's not every day you turn 36.
It's the big 36.
That's right. Yep. Another year closer to the annihilating chasm of death.
That's exactly what happened when you opened the birthday card. That was the little sound that came out of it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The music playing was Heroin by the Velvet Underground.
Bye-bye, buglers.
Bye!